This is Bill Dirks with Terry Saturn, a name that a lot of you will recognize from being the manufacturer or maker, or however you might want to describe it, of the Dancing Servant, a sculptor that appears on the altar in the village center at Holden Village. And along with this interview, we might have a few quips here and there by Gertrude Lundholm. Now, to get into the interview, may I ask you a question here in terms of your relationship to the Holden Village? How'd you ever get associated with the village?
Well, the first year I was...
How long ago, too?
Well, long time ago. The first year was 1962, and I came out with a drama group from Minneapolis, Twin City Religious Drama Players. One of the members of the company was Maren Hinderly, and that was the year that her father had taken over as executive director. And it was just the beginning of a program starting at the village. So our job was to present plays to the guests that came up here. And we had a repertory of, I think it was 4 plays that year that we put on in the evening. We brought all of our scenery and costumes and lighting equipment and everything with us. And we were here for a month that summer doing plays. And likewise the next summer, 1963, we did the same thing. The first year we had to leave for 2 weeks because there was going to be a group in here that Carol was afraid would not be very receptive to theater. So we left for 2 weeks and went to Seattle and Portland and did some performances in various areas around the West. And then we came back after that group had left.
There was at that time no equipment here anyhow, was there?
Equipment?
Stage equipment.
Oh no, there was none. I built some when I got here out of tin cans from the dining hall. And at that time we were operating on diesel generators, so when I would turn on the lights would come up bright on the stage, and then the diesel generators couldn't quite handle the load of those stage lights, and they would dip way down real dim, and then they would kind of ease back up, and the whole process took about 10 seconds to get the lights up to full. And sometimes the generators would just kick out when we turned on the stage lights.
The lights that are in the village center, the spotlights, are still the ones he made out of tin cans. Oh. We're still using those.
Yeah, well, that's something to look at. I haven't looked at those recently.
I remember when you did that. It was the first time we... Well,
onto the stage proper, right?
We used down?
Onto the altar.
That part.
Still our present system, which is what he started with the tin cans.
Yeah. Being in the theater business now, I think I'm going to send some new lighting equipment out here.
That would be helpful, I guess, but it's kind of nostalgic to keep them around a while, you know.
Well, I use them when I actually talk about the ceiling. You know, they had me do the talk on Rich Cameron and to explain what the ceiling's about, so then I spotlight. Yeah. So I turn those things according to what we're looking at.
Okay, good. That helps. All right, back to you.
Then I fell in love with the place immediately. Actually, I'd heard about it before I came out here. My grandparents came out, and I think it was 1960. They were friends of Gilbert's, And they came up here and worked, kind of getting the place in shape. My grandmother still talks about it. She's 101 now. She had a good time up here. Mm.
Would you say that the village contributes to longevity?
I would hope so.
Did she ever get back here?
No, no, she never did. No. Mm. Well, vicariously through me.
Yeah. Well, that's helpful. Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, then I fell in love with the place, and the next year I came back on the staff, and likewise, for the next 8 or 9 summers, whatever, I was here on the staff, doing primarily electrical work, putting heat in the chalets, little space heaters, and learned how to climb power poles and did all of the highline work and put up transformers and worked on the hydroelectric plant and did mechanical work, drove the buses. And
well, the early staff really had to be jack of all trades.
Yes, yeah. Tuned the piano. Beanie and I tuned the piano in the dining hall. I wrote to my dad for some tuning equipment, and he sent it out. And I even, you know, was cooking breakfast and helping Bertha and Esther in the kitchen cook. It was a vital time in my life at that time. It was incredible. And then in 1965, I decided to stay here for the winter. And there started out to be 7 of us, actually, and including Wes Creeb. He was going to be our chaplain for the winter. And by the end of the winter, by about the 1st of March, I believe it was, I was the only person left in the village for various reasons. And it was probably the most incredible time in my life, being here alone for a couple of months. It was gorgeous weather for the most part. I think a lot of people, I was quite young at the time, I think I was 21, and I think a lot of people worried about me up here. I have a feeling that my parents called Carol Hinderly and expressed their concern about my being up here all by myself. But I had no fears, no worries whatsoever. I would snowshoe down for the mail once a week or once every other week, and start out at 3 in the morning and turn off the hydro plant, go down, meet the boat, come back up, and get up about 8 in the evening, and go and turn on the hydro plant. And it was hard work, but very interesting.
Yeah, but was that the present hydro plant?
Yeah.
Yeah, it had already been put in. I'm trying to recall. I thought that was about in. Mm-hmm. 66 or 67, somewhere around in there, to put the hydro plant in?
No, 64, I believe, it went into operation. I would have to check the log books. Mm-hmm. And I took care of the hydro plant for several years after that. And then I was doing some creative work while I was here by myself. I did some metal sculptures using steel from the mill, and that's kind of how I got into that.
What led you then to building the
Dancing Servant?
Yeah, the Dancing Servant. That's one of your first ones here, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. It was a sermon that Carol had given
on
the Dancing Servant and our duty to each other. And it just struck me. Mm-hmm. And
can you describe that for the sake of our listeners here who may not have ever seen it? The towel and so forth.
Well, it's in a way sort of a triumphant Christ image. I think a lot of people read it that way, and it can be that way. But in a sense, it's almost more humanitarian. It's in one hand is a bowl, and draped over the other arm is a towel, and the figure is moving forward in anticipation and joy in performing this duty, whatever the duty is, mm-hmm. washing of the feet.
The accent then is on the word servant.
Pardon?
The accent is on the servant, the
yes.
word servant.
Yeah. Yes.
As being in service to others.
Yes.
Yeah.
With a spirit of joy.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And anticipation. And Carol was very nurturing. Both Carol and Mary were just incredibly nurturing in my artwork and allowing me to do things. And you know, Werner bought welders so I could do some little classes up by the mill, by the mine. And there was so much to draw from thematically around here, mm-hmm. because of all of the issues that were grappled with in the...
Can you name some of those? Is that hitting your back here, memory too old?
Oh, there was growth, both yeah. personal and spiritual. There was depression. A lot of people would get depressed up here, and some of them would come out of it, some of them wouldn't. Mm-hmm. There was just the influence of a lot of different people, and of course there was, you know, I was struggling with my own faith and working out a lot of it through this medium.
Mm-hmm.
And presenting a lot of my thoughts at the time.
What were some of the other works of art that you did up here?
Oh, I did about 100 all in all.
Were you involved with the inscription on the front of the altar then?
No, that was Arnie Flott.
Oh, that's right. That's
yeah.
right. Arnie.
Yeah, and actually that was done before I got here. Mm. I think he did that in 1961.
No, it wasn't that early, because we had come, and we didn't come till 63. And it was either 63 or 64 that he was here for the first time.
Mm. Oh.
And I remember when he went out to get the beams
yes.
out, and he sat over here. He wasn't
yes.
feeling very well. He sat
yeah.
on the porch steps at 6
yeah.
and carved out the letters, and then he gave a sermon on it about the stone that the builders rejected and making
yeah.
it come alive.
Yeah.
So that was
right.
after we came
yeah.
in 63.
All right. Yeah. Good. All right. Where do we go from here now?
Should I tell my story, Gertrude?
I don't know. Do you want it on tape? I think it's fun.
when I was here alone that spring, there was a lot of snow, actually, late in the year. And May 9th, 1966, it was 83 degrees in the village, and there was 60 inches of snow on the ground. And it was so gorgeous. It was just a spectacular day. And the whole valley smelled like pine, because the avalanches were beginning to melt and all the sap was beginning to flow, and it was, oh, like the beginning of life. And so I took off all my clothes and went snowshoeing nude up to Heart Lake all by myself.
What was the temperature?
83 degrees.
Yeah, but it got cooler as you went up, didn't it?
Oh, but I was working pretty hard, snowshoeing.
Yeah.
And I never told that to Werner because it was not a very wise thing to do. There were still avalanches happening.
Yeah, but you're all by yourself, you and God.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. And His creation.
Wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Talk about freeing.
It was
a very freeing experience.
Yeah, it was a wonderful experience.
It was white as snow, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. A Forest Service plane flew over and I went and hid under a tree.
Well, that, if they have cameras on that plane. That's all right. Mm-hmm. Great.
Mm-hmm. And then the subsequent years were pretty much the same in my duties here. I continued to do a lot of electrical work, putting, you know, all the electric heat in the dorms and a lot of highline work and finishing off the hydro plant and then the winter community began to grow, the winter program.
Now, what was the approximate space of years here on this that you're talking about now?
Well, this, let's see, I was here the winters of 1965 and 66, and then I left for a year and came back. And what winter was it that?
You were here in 69 when we were here. We were a small group.
Yes.
No organized program at that time. We made our own. Mm-hmm. Corey and Mary were here, and Ruth and Joe, you and Harv and Jean.
The Geringers.
Walt and
Jean.
Dave and Mary Carlson were here for at least part of that period.
Mm-hmm.
And Franz and Elsie. But they left about Christmas time because they couldn't take the cold.
That's right, yes.
Well, it's good to name those because it kind of gives us a perspective here. Also, we might think about maybe inviting others to interviews about that time. We're a little short of interviews on that early period, I think.
Dave Stimson was...
Though we have quality rather than quantity really right now.
Was a war, Vietnam War?
Yes,
had he had come back. He was having real problems because he'd been involved in killing a lot of people. I mean, it's real traumatic for him to deal with that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He was one that was here alone. Mm-hmm. And did Dave Tinsley come that?
Dave Tinsley just kind of appeared on the snowmobile one day up from the lake. A pastor of his had referred him up.
And by this time, Karen Strom was here. Now, I can't remember when she started, but she was the registrar and everything for the beginning.
Yes. Jim Skinlaw.
I think maybe Karen started the year we came that year.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to think of hers back in 63, but she came later and was here the full year then, from then on, for what, 9 years, 11 years?
In the library on the tape. She's already on the tape.
Does she talk about all the Scrabble?
Right. I remember you were here when the Kent State incident happened.
Yes.
And
yes.
I remember you getting mad at that. And I still remember how powerful you were. You know, we were real depressed with that incident, and Carol had gone on about what's happening in this country. And you got up and did math when you start with the Christus Rex, you know, Christ was. I still remember how potent he was. Yeah. He wasn't the chaplain either. Yeah,
that's no excuse.
I guess, you know, very often up here we've become kind of complacent and remote from what was really happening. And I just felt it was important to drive this into people, mm-hmm. the gravity of the situation, because it really affected me. Mm-hmm. Well, at the beginning of that winter, I built the harpsichord, which we used throughout the winter in Koinonia. We would have...
And we still have that around someplace?
Yes.
We use it, except it gets beaten up sometimes.
Yeah.
We used it a lot.
Yes, we did. It was... It was wonderful.
Well, it must have been quality building there because it lasted this long now. What's that, 20 years, 25 years?
23 years. Oh, we had a wonderful time that winter in that small community. There was a lot of...
Well, Holden didn't have people coming in as they do now, you know, mm-hmm. so Carol decided we should take Holden out. And so that spring, we went out and had services all during Lent, and we took turns. People from who were up here went out, and Beanie did choir workshops in churches in Spokane, and then we went mm-hmm. to Seattle, and we went over to Portland. And you were with us some of those times, I think. Harv drove the truck, Billy truck, because we right. traveled in the truck.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yes.
Right, and we had started the weaving project up here. Mm-hmm. The only place it had been taught anywhere was at our college back in Illinois by a Scandinavian woman. Mm-hmm. She had lived in Seattle. Carol and Mary, in the meantime, said we should have weaving up here. Mm-hmm. So they said, go to Seattle and get a loom. Well, we contacted this woman who had taught us, who lived in Seattle. She mm-hmm. gave us two names in Seattle of weavers. One was already on a tour, weaving tour, and the other one was a Norwegian woman who had classes in her basement. So we went over and bought the first loom, mm-hmm. which is Leclerc, which is still down here being used. And then when we had the workshop at Magnolia Church, the pastor there, I can't remember now what his name was, he said, we're moving, and we think this so Swedish loom we've got in the attic should go to Holden, and it's the big one that's mm-hmm. down here now. With all the pieces that came with it, was the stretchers and the yarn wander, you know, all came in that one piece. Well, we took it that night in the truck, and he put it together. You and Harv worked on it? We put it up in the balcony here?
Yeah.
And worked on it all winter to get the thing put together.
Did it work?
Yeah, it's still working. It's a wonderful piece of equipment. Yeah.
So, what were some of the other things that you worked at, that you built?
You made another
big
sculpture.
I mean, you
sculpture.
Said about 100 of them, you know. But
oh, the sculptures.
Yeah, sculptures.
Well, I did a whole series of Christ figures. Mm-hmm. Christ crucified, the triumphant Christ, Christus Rex. A whole series of those, which some were commissioned by individuals. Some are in churches around mm-hmm. the U.S. I did a sculpture of Martin Luther for the Augsburg Room Augsburg College, their centennial room there.
You made one for Rudy Dorsch. You gave me one. It's a yes. flower. Iris.
Yes. Yes, I did some flowers
right.
out of the shrapnel from the dynamiting of the mill when they were salvaging. And there were these twisted, blown out pieces of metal that I created the flowers.
You have them pretty well cleaned up now up there at the mill?
Well, there's still 100 years of sculpting possibilities.
The way it looks to me.
Right.
Well, not are any of your pieces here in the village yet, besides the dancing servant?
There was a piece last year. I think Maggie Ekman had it in her office. And I don't know what happened to that. It was a wall.
Maybe you took it with them.
Yeah, they might have.
You did the one that was by the powerhouse. I mean, as you go over the footbridge, it was a life-sized one.
Yes.
Of Christ, like it was on the cross. One.
Yeah.
I don't know where that was. Maybe that was a commission piece that you somebody got it.
No, it wasn't. I don't know where that went. There were several large pieces that I did that have disappeared. My guess is they got in the way for some building project.
Do you work primarily in metal then, as far as sculpture?
Yes. Issues? Yeah. That's not the way I started out. I started out in cement in college, sculpting in cement. Mm-hmm.
Were you here the winter they had the fire in Shelley too?
Oh, yes.
Because I wasn't here yet.
Yes.
Must have been like 64?
No, that would have been 66.
Okay.
Yeah, I was up in the garage, and Ardell Eirich came running up there over the snow and said, Shelley 2 is on fire, and We jumped in the snowmobile and tore down here, ran to the firehouse, stretched out the hose, opened up the valve, no water. Went to the next firehouse, dug down into that. We were not prepared for fire. We should have been, but we weren't. We just, the thought never entered our minds to.
This was in late fall, wasn't it?
No, this was in the middle of the winter.
Oh, but it was still, what, 66?
66, 67, I guess.
I know Mary and Horty were here.
Yeah.
And none of you fellows were around. You were all up there.
We were all up in the shop. And no water in the other hydrant. And I realized at that point that we didn't have 75,000 gallons of water in the water tank. It was empty. So I knew there was a bypass valve from the hydroelectric line into the domestic water line somewhere near the mill on the slope up there. So, but it wasn't marked. I knew approximately where it was. I'd never used it before, but I knew it was there. So I tore up there in the snowmobile and just kind of blindly dug down through 5 feet of snow and didn't get anything. I moved over about 3 feet and there was the valve, and I opened that up right away. By that time it was too late to save the chalet.
I think so.
But our concern was that it would take out everything else. Mm-hmm. It would just spread right around the village. The snow was there was a lot of snow on the roofs of chalets 1 and 3, which really saved them, because that snow started melting and dripping down, keeping everything wet. It was a terrifying experience. And the only thing that didn't burn was Mary Christman's Bible.
Right.
Didn't burn at all.
In chalet too?
In chalet
yeah.
too.
How was that protected?
She said, no, she calls that a miracle.
Yeah. Yes.
Where did she have it?
In their room or whatever.
And was it exposed? Like it's sitting out on the
bedside
table?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it was totally exposed. Yeah.
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
I may remember she showed the pages, you know, sort of scorched.
A little scorched a little bit?
Yeah.
Huh. Just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's probably some sort of a technical explanation for that, you know, that the heat just caused a kind of a vacuum in there that over the Bible. And
well, I think the reason is that it was a Bible that had very thin pages, and so it was very dense.
It wasn't very big either.
Well, it was about that thick.
Oh,
so it was
okay.
It was one of those older Bibles.
That's for the benefit of our listeners, that's about an inch.
About an inch, yes.
This is not an audio visual.
Yes, it's the camera.
All right. So where do you want to go from here?
Well, I don't know. Where should I go from here?
Tell them about the incident when you were here. I mean, the fellows that were up here with you and the liquor that came. You don't have to mention the name, but how hard that was for you here. He was an electrician, wasn't he?
Oh, yes.
The scary part of your being with him here.
Yes, that was the end of that winter when I ended up being here alone. He was an alcoholic who had gone to college with my father and my aunt, actually. And his father was a pastor in the Lutheran Free Church, as was my grandfather. So there was a kind of a bond just between us. And we worked together for a couple of years. He was an alcoholic, recovering, and his sister had strongly urged him to come up here, maybe forced him to come up here to try and kick this problem. But he never could quite do it. Anyway, he left. He went out for a week and that winter and flew back in by helicopter. He did have quite a bit of money on his own. And brought in cases of bourbon. And he stayed in his bedroom in Chalet 1 and drank all day long for a couple of weeks. He wouldn't eat anything. He just drank right out of the bottle in his bed, smoking about 5 packs of cigarettes a day. And I was very concerned because he was getting weaker and weaker and weaker. I could tell that. And I tried to get him to eat something, but he just couldn't eat anything. Finally, he agreed to eat some potato soup, so I made potato soup for him. And gradually, he was able to get up enough strength to get out of bed and do something. But then one night we were eating some beef or whatever it was, and he choked on a piece of meat. And I couldn't get it out. It was before the days of the Heimlich maneuver. I didn't know what that was. And so I was hitting him on the back between the shoulder blades, trying to get this out. He couldn't cough it up. He ended up on the floor on all fours, and he was beginning to turn blue, and I thought it was just a matter of seconds until he blacks out. Finally, the piece of meat came up, and during this whole process, I just had visions of myself hauling a dead body down the mountain on a toboggan with snowshoes. And when that piece of meat came out, I was so relieved and so angry. I called him every name I could think of, and he couldn't quite understand why I was so angry at what had happened. And so he packed up and he left, and I ended up to be the only one left here.
How long did he last after that?
I don't know.
Oh.
I don't know.
In other words, you've lost touch with him.
Yeah.
Well, that's quite an experience. I wouldn't relish it.
No, I was pretty naive at that time, and I didn't know how to handle the situation. And I know that Werner worried about that up here. I know that he worried about it. And I was trying to be as helpful as I could in the process of his healing, but I didn't have the training or expertise at that point in my life.
Well, fortunately, things have changed now. We have access to proper maneuvers and whatnot. That also helps.
Were you here when they ripped out Koinonia? Did we start that early?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And the Orlos were here, and they were making it into the...
Max and Eleanor.
Right. Yes. Mm-hmm. But I mean, they were here early, too, and were peeling the logs that went into...
Yes, yeah, I was involved in all of that. I stripped the old sinks out of all of the old rooms and the toilets and worked a lot on that building.
On Koinonia?
On Koinonia, when it was a dormitory.
Yeah. That's the building we're in now.
Right.
Yes.
We're sitting right in it.
Yes, we are.
Just to bring it back to the reality.
Right. Yeah. This is the new addition to it, which was added after I left.
Mm-hmm. Good. All right.
What about the heating, you know, that eventually we had? I mean, the village center was not heated at all.
No.
The first year we were here, and we were all told, bring your blankets down,
blankets,
and we wrapped ourselves in blankets for Sunday morning services. You couldn't stand and they were sort of dead cold.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't remember how soon after that, then the hydro came in. The organ was already there.
Yes.
Because that happened when Bill Berg was still here with the youth groups.
Yes. The interesting thing about the organ, I remember, was that it's cycle sensitive. And if it isn't getting 60 cycles a second, it goes out of pitch. So it kind of wavered all over the place.
Yeah, I remember that sound. And then when the hydro got done and we told Gil Berg, you know, all of a sudden it was brilliant and the lights were on, you know, we said, it had a totally different sound. It was so exciting. And he wouldn't believe that it affected the organ, but it did.
Oh,
it
certainly.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you should have demonstrated it for him. You know, all you had to do was put a rheostat on the current line.
Well, that wouldn't have affected the cycles. The cycles.
Oh, that's right. It was the
cycles.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
But I can remember Beanie sort of rolling his eyes, you know, at times when he was playing.
Yeah.
And I remember the play, two of the plays you put on. One was Dear Wormwood.
Dear Wormwood.
And the Cocktail Party.
Cocktail Party by T.S. Eliot. We did Uncle Vanya by Chekhov.
Right.
We did Brand by Ibsen.
They were good plays.
Yeah. What else did we do? I can't remember the others.
It was about that time, too, that Ernie Flotten was supposed to have come, and he couldn't come. So he sent some student artists out who were here about the same time as you were. And they were doing all kinds of drawings and sketches and around the village. Katie mm-hmm. Sherson was one. I don't know who all of them were. But they were sort of your age and Maren Hendry's age. I think there were four or six artists that came out that he provided scholarship money or something for them to be here since he couldn't. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he came the next year.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the time we started. They were singing protest songs. You know, and we, one of them that they brought was Little Houses on the Hillside.
Yes.
You know, they all looked just the same. Kids all go, you know, the words. We all thought that was wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's when we put in the shaft down by the pool room.
Right.
And a couple years later, put in the lift. Mm-hmm. And every night there were things happening down there, these songs from the 60s, and mm-hmm. Eating Peanuts.
Blowing in the Wind? Is that
Blowing
one of them?
In the Wind, all of those
Pete
songs.
Seeger.
Yeah, Pete Seeger. Helen Landsberg was here and wrote a lot of things and performed
right.
down there in the evenings.
What Do I Wear to Church? Isn't that one of hers?
Yes.
Yeah, she is still coming when we first came here,
mm-hmm.
which was in 66.
Yeah.
Not right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. And about this time, all the arts started growing here because there was more time. We were done repairing the windows and that sort of thing, so there was more time for the arts activities, the pottery and sculpture and painting, a lot of painting. Betty Olson started coming
yeah.
out about that time.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, she was here early because it was shortly after that the little girl died and they gave the money for the Ginny's Corner,
mm-hmm.
a light children's mm-hmm. library.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, they commissioned me to do a sculpture for her school in St. Paul.
What was the sculpture up?
Children playing and growing, kind of a celebration of life.
Mm-hmm.
I did that in 1970.
Right. Well, I can remember you being here. I think I saw you then. We were up here in 70 sometime. I don't know when it was. I don't remember when it was at all. But that's neither here nor there. But I personally, both my wife and I, really appreciate what you've done around here, particularly in that statue. That tells so much of what Holden is all about. Now, how much you
would have expected it?
Yeah. Well,
it sort of completes the whole attitude
yeah.
of the volunteer service.
Yeah.
We all come here and work, and the equality.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
We're all the
yeah,
same.
It's symbolic of the majority of staff here. Let's put it that way. Well,
right.
I would say all of staff, really, but the fact we have volunteer staff and that the village primarily run is operated by volunteer staff is really symbolized in that particular statue.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they're going forth there with this moment, movement here outward, forward, has behind it a kind of an indication that, all right, we leave here and what do? We still carry that same spirit when we go out of the village into the, quote, real world, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we like about it.
Another significant aspect to the 60s up here for me was the black issue at that time in society. And Will Hertzfeld was here, and Jim Cohn. And they radically changed my way of thinking. I lived in Chalet One with Will Hertzfeld and his family, and we became quite close, and I lived on the third floor, they lived on the second floor, and he called me the dark at the top of the stairs.
The what at the top of the
dark?
The dark.
Yeah. Because we hit it off so well.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, good.
I can, of course, there are 1,000 stories.
How you feel right now?
Well, I would like to come back and spend an extended period of time here again at some point.
You should.
Well, you have now a certain commitment to kind of a different kind of world, let's put it that way, in terms of you're getting involved in more acting and so forth.
Well, I don't act. I'm involved
in the what?
In the technical end of things.
Production,
technical production.
Did you do stage design? You said it a lot.
Well, I used to design, but my job is so administrative now because I have about 60 people that work for me, and so it's pretty administrative.
Mm-hmm. Where do you get a chance to, or how do you get a chance to exercise your talents then, other than administrative?
Well, since I've been a designer, stage designer in the past, I think I'm a really good complement to designers, and mm-hmm. I've worked with the best in the world, actually, in my theatrical experiences, so I understand where they're going, and I can make suggestions to them if there are problems, or if they're having a problem resolving some design issues, mm-hmm. and I know that they appreciate my input. Mm-hmm. And my artistic bent.
Well, you went from here and went back to Minneapolis to the Guthrie.
Yes, yeah.
And so you were been associated with the Guthrie Theater for a long time, too.
Mm-hmm. In the Minnesota Opera Company with Phil Burnell.
Mm-hmm.
Were you still there when they did Ibsen play your Gent? In Minneapolis, had you
no,
left
at
or
that,
were you involved?
Yeah, at that time I was at the Science Museum of Minnesota, as director of exhibits, and I was there for 7 years. And then I went back to the Guthrie. They offered me a different position, so I went back during a troubled time in the institution, and was there for 2 years and mm-hmm. got an offer from the Seattle Repertory Theater, and I snapped it right up. I was anxious to get back out here.
You worked with Brandlin, the sculptor. Did you study with him for a while?
Well, I was going to. I had applied to be his assistant, and then I went mountain climbing in Europe, and there was a mix-up in our correspondence, and in the meantime, he hired someone else because he couldn't get in touch with me. And we talked about it several years later, mm-hmm. Because he said that he really would have enjoyed working mm-hmm. with me. And so I missed out on that opportunity.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me you crammed a lot of activities here in a not too long a time of living, right?
Well, 47 years.
All right. Good. Well, do you have anything more to tell us?
Oh, I don't think so.
No?
You're
going to quit on that, huh?
I'm happy to be here and see Gertrude here.
Yeah.
She provides such a great sense of continuity between the generations at Holden, and it's just fun to see the changes and the things, the spirit that's still the same.
Mm. Yeah, fine. Okay. You
have the same for me, you know. Same. It's real great to have him back here.
Right.
And to know how much he was a part, even more than we realized when we were here. Yeah. You know. Even this Mark, what's Mark's last name, sat at breakfast with us, that did the plumbing.
Bjerke.
Yeah. I mean, his story is too, and having it fix the toilets and the pipes underneath and having the toilets all come up with hot water and stuff, you know, in on that whole experience.
Oh, yeah.
You were working with those same problems that we had.
The early days.
Right. And every sink leaked in every lodge. I remember all of us helped with the cleaning, and you did it over and over again because of.
Yeah, but things still leak.
Oh, and you came up and worked a lot with that. You know that area,
to the plumber, you know.
Right.
My little short skinhead plumber that I followed around, Lloyd was Sheen? No, not Sheen. No. Anyhow, Lloyd, the plumber. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I became his.
Yeah, Bilba has to do the dirty work. I mean, we're down in the drain fields and all that.
Not only that, but I had all the stuffed up toilets I had to. I was offered in quotes, you know, of cleaning out the stop toilets. I think in those days the flush toilets. In those days we were using a little different kind of toilet paper that got stuck all the time. All right, well.
This goes from pastor to working on cesspools and so forth. That's what's amazing about this place. I'm still going to give a man's on servanthood here.
You leave your title behind when
you
come into these gates here or through the village. Mm-hmm. And you are a plain human being who needs loving and who can love in the name of Christ. And that's the important thing.
Mm-hmm. And it can be certain things can be a humbling experience, which is always very
important. Yeah.
Working on toilets and cesspools can be
but so essential to our
scrubbing the jacuzzi.
Yeah.
Yes,
that's the better one.
Did you help with the building of the jacuzzi?
Oh yes, and actually with the first sauna. The first year I was here, that the sauna behind the hotel was the garbage room.
Oh, I know that.
And then the next year we. Sauna.
But you weren't involved in the river saunas, right?
Yes, I built one of them. And
the first one burnt, didn't it?
The
river.
Yes, the first log one burned. And then I put up a quick one that was not a log one. And the first time I fired it up, it burned down. But I think I was here by myself then. So then this large one was built.
Yeah, I don't remember a third one being in the history, just the two.
Yeah, but it had a very brief history.
But I remember the jacuzzi built. And first they were going to put it at the top of the hill, and they said, well, we never have water pressure up that high for the jacuzzi.
Mm-hmm.
It had to come down anyway. And it was two retired couples, I think, from
two
either
brothers,
Minnesota or Dakotas, gave it as a therapy pool.
The thing, didn't they?
Yes.
Well, it's had a lot of use over the years. I've used it on occasion, especially after a hike.
Oh, it's wonderful in the middle of winter.
Yeah.
And there's 6 feet of snow around there, and the moon is full on.
We kept it on. You know, we were that small community. We were allowed to keep it on all the time. And you could go out at 2 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. With all that snow around you, sit in that hot water.
Yeah.
That's what I told you on the interview before that got in the book.
Yeah.
Think about walking down in my bathing suit and snow boots.
Yeah, we're still trying to get you to do that again.
Well, I still have the picture of it.
Got to put that on exhibit, right?
Yes. Oh, definitely.
Well, it was fun. We brought newspapers to put your clothes on, you know, your towel to keep it dry. Mm-hmm. Then you just got out and sat in the snow, and the snow was this high around you.
Yeah, that's approximately 3 feet high.
It was wonderful.
Plus.
Well, it had to be 5 feet, I think.
5 feet, okay. All right.
That's right. I'm demonstrating now.
You're sitting down and demonstrating. Okay. All right. Well, I think we can probably close off this interview. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And your bringing us up, filling in part of the story here, that is the story of Holden Village.
Tell me how you were involved with Gordon. You said you're mentioned in the book.
Gordon Stewart?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was involved in a couple of ways.
This is a P.S. on the tape.
P.S., yeah. Gordon Stewart was up at Domke Lake for about 60 years, mm-hmm. I think. And he and Dindy from Moore's Point and Oscar Getty would get together every Friday and drink. And Oscar's wife, Mona, would take the ferry boat down. And these three old guys, hermits, very reclusive, would get together and have their party for the weekend. And I was around for a couple of those parties, but I was kind of an outsider, I guess. I was young. But I liked hearing their stories. They're trapping and mm-hmm. mining in this valley during the turn of the century, actually. And then one spring, Werner and Judy and I hiked up to Domke Lake to visit Gordon, and we brought a pie up, and we played chess, and Gordon pulled a fool's checkmate on me. I mean, he was an expert at chess, and I didn't know much at all about chess, but he got me in the first move, or first two moves, mm-hmm. whatever a fool's checkmate is. And then we didn't finish the pie, and so when we were about to leave, Werner said, "Well, Gordon, we'll just leave the rest of this pie for you." And he said, "You bet your life you will. You're not taking that with you." There was no.
You mean it was that small pie, or that big a pie that there was something left over, or didn't you guys eat?
There was about half a pie left.
Oh,
over,
yeah. Must have been very hungry.
Mm-hmm. And actually, Gordon offered to give me, to will me all everything he had if I would come up there and just help him and take care of him the rest of his life. And I couldn't make that commitment at that mm-hmm. point in my life. I didn't want to be stuck up at Domke Lake with this old salty
trapper. He was a salty character.
Yeah.
So I said thanks, but no thanks. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's the story of Gordon.
Well, that's a good addition because he was quite a feature around here in terms of his reputation and so forth.
Well, and so were the Gettys.
Yeah.
The village kind of took care of them for a while.
Yeah.
And Oscar always had the coffee pot on that winter that had boiled all day, or 2 or 3 days maybe,
yeah,
I don't know.
Like
but
tar.
When it was cold and we went out, you went into their place and you had that strong coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And then Mona was, they brought her up here quite often. Mm-hmm. Christmas time we had her come up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She used to teach in the school up here.
And they had me investigating. They had some relatives in Chicago. I guess they thought it would be easy for me to get some records. It was somebody who owned land down by them. And they wanted to get that land in addition to mm-hmm. what they had, you know. And we were supposed to go to Chicago and find this person and get the deeds and everything. In the meantime, somebody else bought it, whatever it was.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks
Thank
a lot.
You. Thank you.
We wish you well.
Thank you.
And Godspeed.
Thank you.
I'll
be back.
Often.
Yeah. Thank you.
Maybe next week I'll be back.
Thank you.